Coming up on Star Stuff, space weather events ramping up as the sun continues its relentless movement towards solar max. Astronomers discover the oldest galaxy cluster ever seen. And new research into antimatter. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
The Sun's unleashed one of its most powerful solar storms in years. A series of massive eruptions have sent radiation and plasma hurtling towards the Earth at high speed. Luckily, instead of copping a head-on hit, the Earth's only been sideswiped by the latest geomagnetic storms. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, America's Weather Bureau, had forecast solar storms as strong as Level 3 and possibly the most powerful since 2004. And NASA described them as being possibly severe. Luckily, the near misses have meant no power blackouts, damaged satellites, or serious communications issues. Geomagnetic and radiation storms are growing more frequent as the Sun continues moving towards solar max, the peak of its 11-year solar cycle, when the Sun's north and south poles flip. That peak is likely to be either later this year or early next. While these events don't pose a serious problem for life on Earth, thanks to the planet's protective magnetic field, technology, easily susceptible to electrical and magnetic fields, might not be so lucky. A solar storm back in 1989 blacked out much of Quebec, and the last solar max, which was around the turn of the century, fried several satellites, including a Japanese probe on an interplanetary mission. Over the last few days, there have been numerous solar storms caused by eruptions on the Sun's surface. Dr. Matthew Francis from the Bureau of Meteorology's Ionospheric Prediction Service monitors space weather in Australia.
It has been busy. We've had quite a number of some reasonably significant solar X-ray flares, which have blasted off clouds of material from the Sun that's had some sort of further effects when they've managed to sort of hit Earth.
And they've sort of come in several waves.
Yeah, that's correct. We had what was called, so an X-class flare is a fairly significant X-ray flare. And we had an X1 flare, which sent off a cloud of plasma from the Sun. And we sort of clipped the edge of that, although even though it was sort of the edge of it, it was quite a significant event still in terms of the disturbance it caused to the Earth's magnetic field. But in the midst of that disturbance, we also had an X5 flare, which is quite a bit more significant. And the coronal mass ejection, the ejection of plasma from that event, headed straight towards us and moving quite fast.
This one's going to be powerful enough to be registered on instruments orbiting Mars as well as here on Earth. Is that fairly unique that something's that strong that it does that?
In terms of recent years, there certainly hasn't been events as big as this is likely to be since kind of 2003, 2004, in sort of that sort of the end of the last solar cycle. Mm. And we've been sort of then in the low part of the cycle since then, and we're ramping up. So yes, in terms of, you know, recent history, it's quite new, and there are a lot more instruments. We have a lot more satellites that are studying the Sun, and a lot more technology that's dependent on, you know, things that can be affected by this sort of these extreme events than we did have. So, you know, it's interesting to see how all those systems will cope now that, you know, we're getting more activity again. There's a range of things that won't have experienced this level of event for some years.
That's Dr. Matthew Francis from the Bureau of Meteorology's Ionospheric Prediction Service. Space weather starts at the Sun. It begins with an eruption such as a huge burst of light and radiation called a solar flare, or from a gigantic cloud of solar material called a coronal mass ejection. But the effects of these eruptions happen at Earth, or at least near Earth space. Scientists monitor several kinds of space weather events. There are geomagnetic storms, solar radiation storms, and radio blackouts, all caused by the same group of immense explosions on the Sun. Geomagnetic storms are among the most common forms of space weather. Basically, a geomagnetic storm refers to any time the Earth's magnetic environment, that is the magnetosphere, undergoes sudden and repeated change. This is a time when magnetic fields continually realign and energy dances quickly from one area to another. Geomagnetic storms occur when several types of coronal mass ejections connect up with the outside of the magnetosphere for a period of extended time. The solar material in a coronal mass ejection travels with its own set of magnetic fields. If the fields point northwards and they align with the magnetosphere of the Earth's own fields, the energy and the particles simply slide around the Earth, causing little change. However, if the magnetic fields point southwards in the opposite direction to the Earth's fields, the effects can be dramatic. The Sun's magnetic fields peel back the outermost layers of the Earth's fields, changing the whole shape of the magnetosphere. This is the initial phase of a geomagnetic storm. The next phase, the main phase, can last for several hours or several days as charged particles sweeping up into the magnetosphere accumulate more and more energy and speed. These particles penetrate closer and closer to the planet. The increase in the lower altitude of this radiation can also damage satellites orbiting the planet. The final stage of a geomagnetic storm lasts for several days as the magnetosphere returns to its original state. Now, geomagnetic storms don't always require coronal mass ejection. Mild storms can be caused by something called a co-rotating interaction region, or a CIR. These intense magnetic regions form when high-speed solar winds overtake slower ones, thus creating complicated patterns of fluctuating magnetic fields. And these, too, can interact with the edges of the Earth's magnetosphere, creating weak to moderate geomagnetic storms. Usually, geomagnetic storms are measured by ground-based instruments. They observe just how much the horizontal component of the Earth's magnetic field varies. And based on these measurements, the storms are categorized from a G1, which is fairly minor, to a G5, which is extreme. In the most extreme cases, transformers in terrestrial power grids can be damaged, spacecraft operations and satellite tracking can be hindered, high-frequency radio propagation and satellite navigation systems can be blocked, and auroral activity appears much further away from the poles than usual. Another type of storm is referred to as a solar radiation storm. Solar radiation storms, which are also called solar energetic particle events, is pretty well what it sounds like, an intense flow of radiation from the sun. Both coronal mass ejections and solar flares can carry out such radiation, made up of free-floating protons and electrons and other charged particles. The radiation is blocked by the magnetosphere and atmosphere, so it can't reach humans on the ground. Now, while such a storm can harm people travelling from, say, the Earth to the Moon or to Mars, it has little effect closer to the planet's surface, where, say, airlines travel, or for that matter, where the International Space Station orbits. Solar radiation storms can disturb regions through which high-frequency radio communications travel. Therefore, during a solar radiation storm, aircraft travelling routes over the poles can't use GPS but need to rely exclusively on radio communications. Usually, as we've seen in the past week or so, the aircraft are rerouted. A good example being Qantas, which rerouted some of its South American flights. Solar radiation storms are rated on a scale from S1, which is fairly minor, to S5, which is extreme. The ratings are determined by just how many very energetic fast solar particles move through a given area of space in the atmosphere. At their most extreme, solar radiation storms can cause complete high-frequency radio blackouts. They can damage electronics, memory and imaging systems on satellites, and the radiation can poison any astronauts outside the Earth's magnetosphere. The third type of event are simply referred to as radio blackouts, and they occur when the strong sudden burst of X-rays from a solar flare hits the Earth's atmosphere, jamming both high and low frequency radio signals. The X-rays disturb a layer of the Earth's atmosphere known as the ionosphere. It's through the ionosphere which radio waves usually travel. The constant changes in the ionosphere change the paths of radio waves as they move, thus degrading the information they're carrying. And this affects both high and low frequency radio waves alike. It's the loss of low frequency radio communications which cause GPS measurements to be off, sometimes by meters, other times by kilometers. And they can also affect the applications that govern satellite positioning. Scientists using a new technique have discovered the oldest galaxy cluster ever detected. The newly found cluster is some 10.3 billion light-years away, dating to a time when the universe was just a quarter of its current age. The discovery, reported in the astrophysical journal Letters, will help astronomers understand how galaxies evolve and are influenced by their environment. Galaxy clusters are among the largest structures in the universe. They're usually made up of thousands of galaxies bound together and usually containing very old stars. But this newly discovered cluster has just 30 galaxies in it, according to the study's lead author, astrophysicist Dr. Lee Spittler from Melbourne's Swinburne University. Now, this means the cluster is still very young and should continue to grow into an extremely dense structure containing many, many more galaxies in the future. Well, future for it, past from where we are now. Spittler and colleagues used the new four-star camera aboard the Magellan 6.5-metre telescope in Chile to re-examine one of the best-studied regions of the sky. It's an area located in the direction of the constellation Leo and has been carefully examined for thousands of hours using all the major observing facilities both on the ground and in space, including the Hubble Space Telescope. The team used specially designed filters to collect images at specific narrow wavelength sections near the infrared region of the electromagnetic spectrum. Light waves from distant objects such as this cluster are stretched or elongated into the red end of the electromagnetic spectrum by the expansion of the universe. Spittler says the new technique allows scientists to measure distances to thousands of galaxies at a time.
Galaxy cluster is basically one of the largest structures in the universe. It's made up of galaxies, and the thing that really sets it apart between cluster and not cluster galaxies is basically that the galaxies in clusters are very, very old, so they don't form very many stars anymore, and that's probably related to the fact that they're in a cluster, and lots of things happen in clusters, galaxy interactions, mergers and things like that.
Okay, and in this particular case, what's happened is, as you've been looking at images, you've realized that some of the dots in plain sight weren't stars in our galaxy or stars in other galaxies, but they were actually galaxy clusters in the very deep, distant universe. And that was a bit of a surprise in this case.
Yeah. We were basically pointing at one of the most well-studied regions in the sky. Astronomers like to look at really, really faint things, and so you need to spend a lot of time on telescopes looking for the faint things.
One photon at a time.
Yes, basically. And so what we did, we also looked at the same field, but we wanted to do it a bit differently. And the analogy I'm using is basically trying to look for the right puzzle piece when you're doing a puzzle. And people have been staring at all the thousands of puzzle pieces in the sky. But what we did is we actually were a bit clever and sorted the puzzle pieces and isolated basically the few pieces that look like distant galaxies. And once we did that, this cluster just kind of popped right out in the images.
How did you know all the galaxies in this cluster were associated with each other?
Basically, what we do is we've split up the wavelength spectrum, and so we split it up very finely. And once you do that, you can isolate little features in the wavelength spectrum, and in that way, you can tell exactly where that galaxy is. Not exactly, but fairly accurate. Accurately, you can determine how far away the distance of the galaxies.
So when you say wavelength spectrum, are you talking about red shifting and blue shifting, things like that?
Exactly, yeah. So basically, we're looking for how much they've redshifted due to the expansion of the universe. And when they've redshifted a lot, it means they're very, very distant from us. And so we're looking in the near-infrared, and in the near-infrared, basically, you're only sensitive to very distant galaxies. But you still needed to break up the spectrum into fine chunks to actually detect exactly where these galaxies are.
Now, there are about 30 galaxies in this particular cluster, all about, 10.5 billion light years away. That's a significant slice of the age of the universe. That makes the universe very young when these things were already a cluster.
Exactly, yeah. And the very fact that there's only 30 of them tells you that it's a very young structure. The galaxy clusters we see in the nearby universe can contain thousands of galaxies, but because we're viewing this thing when it's very, very young, it's still relatively, it's still an adolescent, basically. And so it only has 30 galaxies, roughly, but it's so large at that distance, it's bound to become a very, very massive and cluster by today.
Your paper doesn't just talk about the discovery of this, it also talks about the need to use special equipment, new techniques to look for these things, filters, things like that.
Yeah, that's correct. So the basic novel approach that we used is to break up the wavelength spectrum, and when you do that, you can isolate exactly where the galaxies are. And to do that, we used a brand new instrument called the Four-Star on a telescope in Chile called Magellan. And that new instrument allowed us to go very, very find very, very faint galaxies. And with the filters, we we were able to isolate exactly where the galaxies are and discover basically the most distant galaxy cluster known to date.
How does the filter work to do that, to let you do that?
Yeah, it's kind of like a camera, like a digital camera, where it basically collects, you know, red, green, and blue, and it combines that information into the image that you see on your computer. And so what the filters that we use were not red, green, and blue. They were over 1 micron in the infrared spectrum. But we still broke it up into 3 channels, and by doing that, you can basically see features, basically pick out colors, particular colors in the near-infrared wavelengths, and by doing that, you can isolate where those galaxies are.
So it's a bit like we don't want to see anything brighter than this, so if it's less bright than this, we want to see it, and everything else is filtered out.
Exactly, yeah, you're focusing in on exactly what you want to find.
When you realized what you had come across, how did you feel?
Oh, very excited. So I was in charge of preparing the data using supercomputers at Swinburne, and I had spent, you know, weeks preparing for this data. We were having a science meeting with all my colleagues in Texas, in the U.S., and so we were all there at the place, and I kind of brought up the images for the first time, and they literally just kind of popped right out. You can see these red, thin clumps of red galaxies, and everyone was very excited, and we knew exactly what we'd found, and mostly because we were so confident in the new technique and its ability to just fine-tune galaxies that are very distant and find structures like this.
That's Dr. Lee Spittler from Melbourne Swinburne University. Scientists have successfully made spectroscopic measurements of a piece of antimatter. A report in the journal Nature claims physicists with the Alpha Collaboration at CERN, the European Centre for Nuclear Research, have successfully probed the internal structure of an antihydrogen atom. The research is an important milestone on the way to measuring the properties of antimatter. It follows reports last June that the same team had successfully trapped antimatter. The new research will help the Alpha team make precision comparisons between atoms of ordinary matter and atoms of antimatter. This will hopefully allow physicists to unravel some of the deepest mysteries of particle physics, which in turn will mean a better understanding of why the universe exists. You see, scientists believe matter and antimatter would have been created in equal amounts in the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. But because matter and antimatter annihilate each other when they come into contact, the universe should have been destroyed almost immediately. Clearly, it wasn't, and scientists really don't know why. The Alpha Collaboration will now try to design experiments to make detailed measurements of antimatter atoms in the hope of working out exactly what's going on, what the differences are which have allowed matter to survive over antimatter. The big mystery is that all the antimatter seems to have gone, leading to the conclusion that nature must have a slight preference for matter over antimatter. If antihydrogen atoms can be studied in detail, as Alpha's latest results suggest, they may provide a powerful new tool for investigating this preference. Hydrogen atoms consist of a single electron orbiting a nucleus made up of a single proton. But by firing photons, in other words, light, at them, the atoms can be excited, with the electron jumping to a higher orbit, eventually relaxing and going back to the ground state in the process, emitting a photon of light. Now, the frequency distribution of the light being emitted forms a very precisely measured spectrum that, in the matter world, is unique to hydrogen. Basic principles of physics say that antihydrogen should have an identical spectrum to hydrogen. And measuring this spectrum is the ultimate goal of the Alpha Collaboration. To trap antihydrogen, scientists developed a sophisticated arrangement of magnetic fields acting on the magnetic orientation of the antihydrogen atoms. The Alpha team then shone microwaves at precisely tuned frequencies on the antihydrogen. These microwaves flipped the antihydrogen's magnetic orientation, thereby liberating the antihydrogen from the trap. Now, as soon as that happens, the antihydrogen meets normal matter and, as you expect, annihilates. But this annihilation leaves characteristic patterns in particle detectors surrounding the trap. And it's these measurements which show that it's possible to set up experiments in which the internal properties of antihydrogen atoms can be changed by shining microwaves on them. Next, the Alpha team will need to work on improving the precision of their microwave measurements, and they'll also want to undertake additional measurements of the antihydrogen spectrum using lasers. We'll keep you informed. She became South Korea's first astronaut when she launched into space in 2008. Recently, Dr. Soyoun Yee was in Adelaide as a guest of the Southern Hemisphere Summer Space Program to encourage international students to take part in space travel. Dr. Yee told the ABC's Nance Haxton that Australians should not be daunted by a lack of a local space program.
Most of people wondering that whether I want to be an astronaut even all the way from the primary school or a three-year-old kid. But yeah, of course, when I watched a movie and an animation about space, I dreamed about being an astronaut when I was a kid. But I'm a Korean, and we didn't have those kind of big space agency like a NASA or Roscosmos. So in real world, it's impossible, seems like. So I gave up. But finally, when I was in graduate school, and then Ministry of Science and Technology announced that Korean government also want to make astronauts, so I thought about my long, long time ago old dream, and then I tried to do that.
And then you had to have intensive training in Russia. What did that involve?
Because Korean government had a contract with the Russian space agency, so we should take a Russian rocket to go to the space station. So I should go to the Russia for 1 year to have a training as a scientist astronaut, not as a navigator.
So that would have been quite an exciting development for you?
Yeah, of course, because I've never imagined that. Even when I applied to astronaut program, there was 36,000 candidates, so I was sure that I cannot make it. But yeah, fortunately and luckily, I could make it and then do space experiment in International Space Station. Finally, Korean government assigned 18 experiments for my space flight.
What memories have you got from that time? It must have been incredible to be able to finally be in space after all that time.
And so many people guess that maybe I could be so nervous, but I feel like I have nothing on my brain except space flight related things. So it's good for me, and I didn't have to be so nervous, but one of my exciting memory for all my life.
And is there any chance that you may be able to go into space again?
Every day I pray for that. But the Korean government doesn't have a stable and long-term human space flight program. So not yet. They don't have any plan to send any other people, not only me, but also any other astronaut. But hopefully in 10 years or 20 years, even though I cannot fly, hopefully another Korean astronaut can fly later to have an experiment in space station or other planet in Mars or Moon.
What do you tell the students here in Australia? I suppose we don't have a space program either. Do you still try to encourage them that perhaps they could go into space as well?
So many engineers and students will prepare for the future space flight or space program. I think they can make it. Even though so many people blame to the politicians or policy, and then to do that, we should have a good space-related policy, but if many publics and many taxpayers want to have it, maybe government officers or politicians cannot deny anymore. So hopefully, to get a chance, you'd better be ready for any time.
So that's the key, to be ready, just in case an opportunity arises like it did for you.
Of course. So being ready is the most important thing.
That was South Korea's first astronaut, Dr. Soyoun Yee, speaking with the ABC's Nance Haxton. And time now once again to turn our eyes to the skies. Jeff White's the senior astronomy educator with the Powerhouse Museum Sydney Observatory. And he joins us now as we continue our journey through March Skywatch.
We've been having a look at the constellation of Taurus. What I'd like you to do at this particular point in time is go up about one open handspan, so that's about 20 degrees, and you'll actually come across another fairly bright orange reddish looking star. Its name has changed over the years, and there's lots of argument about it, including lots of historical argument about it, but these days we typically call this star Betelgeuse. It's also the brightest star, so it's called Alpha Orionis in the constellation of Orion the Hunter. This is a young, very large, dying star. It's about 650 light years away and about 1,000 times the size of the Sun, and yet relatively young at less than 10 million years. And when it does eventually die, we're reasonably sure, though we can't guarantee it, that it will explode as a Type 2 supernova. The name itself, Betelgeuse, it's a mispronunciation of its name that's been handed to us throughout the years, through the Dark Ages to the Middle Ages to the Renaissance, we've basically picked up an interpretation of the Arabic pronunciation, Abd al-Yaza. We believe it comes from an old Arabic name meaning the hand of al-Jaza, meaning the big man or the giant. But strangely, it's been interpreted as being the armpit of the giant. If you've found it, you're well on your way to finding one of the more famous objects in the sky, and that's a group of stars that Australians typically look at and refer to as the Saucepan. But everywhere else around the world, it's referred to as Orion the Hunter. It hasn't always been as such. Some people have actually argued that Orion was, well, somewhat of a dimwit. Dim, because if he's a mighty hunter, he's pretty much, well, standing on a timid little rabbit called Lepus the Hare, and he's chasing the Pleiades, which are often shown to represent a flock of doves. So what sort of mighty hunter steps on a hare and chases doves? And that's been a suggestion that's been around, although, correspondingly, there's lots of ideas that he was, in fact, the mightiest of all the hunters, with a slight attitude problem that boasted at one particular time that he could kill any animal on the planet. Well, the ancient Greeks believed that the mother of the earth, Gaia, was not particularly happy about this idea or this boast, so she sent the giant scorpion Scorpius to attack and kill him, which it did. Other legends say that, well, Orion was so good at hunting that he would be hanging around with the goddess of the hunt, Artemis. Artemis's brother, Apollo, was not so keen on his godly sister going out with a mere mortal, so he is the one who created the giant scorpion to attack and kill Orion the hunter. Whichever story it was, and there are different versions of this, ultimately what happened was that the body of Orion was placed into the sky, as was that of the scorpion, but on directly opposite position, so that the two can never come together and fight again. But they keep an eye on each other as one sets, the other rises. Looking into Orion, it's fairly easy to see three stars in a row, very nicely placed, that make up a perfect straight line. These stars traditionally represent the belt of Orion from which hangs his mighty sword. And if you have a pair of binoculars, but this is quite tricky, you need to either put them onto a tripod or wedge them against the side of a building using a pillow for a bit of support, you may be able to see that the middle star-like object of that handle is not a single star, but rather a little cloud. And the ancient word for cloud is nebula. So what you're looking at is, in fact, the birthplace of stars. It's called M42, or the Great Nebula in Orion. And time again, you'll find that astronomers give things fairly dim classification names. M42 simply means it's the 42nd object in a catalogue developed by Charles Messier. This is truly a spectacular object. If you have a small telescope or even a small pair of binoculars, as long as you can mount them and hold them still, this is a beautiful object to look at. It'll look like a wispy, slightly greyish-greenish cloud of gas and dust. Look a little bit higher and almost overhead, you'll see the brightest star in the night sky, called Sirius the Dog Star. Not only is it the brightest star in the night sky, it's also one of the closest. Now, there are about seven which are indeed closer, but this is a lovely combination of being close and bright. It's only about twice the mass of the Sun, but 25 times brighter. And at 8.6 light years away, it makes it the perfect combination for this brilliant, dazzling star that we can see. This star was used by Egyptians thousands and thousands of years ago to work out the length of the year on average to be 365 1/4 days, in a process called heliacal rise. You see, they would watch the position of Sirius in relation to the morning sun. After Sirius was lost in the glare of the sun for around about 70 days, they would be watching for it in the morning, and that first chance that they had to see Sirius separated from the glare of the sun, the first time you do that, it's called heliacal rise. And by keeping accurate records year after year after year, they were able to work out the length of the year to 365 1/4 days. To actually improve on that accuracy the Egyptians were able to do, it took another few thousand years to come up with the exact measurements that we have today. So stars, as I hope you're getting to see, are not only pretty, but they're also useful. They act as a marker in the sky. We can use them to work out time of year. We can use them to work out our cardinal directions. So they're beautiful and useful.
That's the Powerhouse Museum's senior astronomy educator, Jeff Wyatt. For more details, you can go to sydneyastronomy.com.au. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.